If you want to build wealth, buying a house might actually be the absolute worst place to start.
Oh, wow. Okay, coming in hot today.
I know, right? But just like picture this for a second. You've been saving up, you're sitting on a decent pile of capital, and you finally decide it's time to build a real estate portfolio.
Right, time to make the money work for you.
Exactly. You want it to work for you instead of the other way around. But almost immediately, you just hit this massive classic brick wall.
Yeah.
And the wall is simply, where do you actually put the money?
It's the ultimate paralysis by analysis. The moment you
Sure.
start looking at the sheer variety of property types out there, the intimidation factor just skyrockets.
It totally does. You look to your left, and there's residential property, right? Like apartments, suburban villas, townhouses, and it feels, well, safe.
Yeah, it's familiar.
But then you look right, and there's commercial real estate. You've got office buildings, retail hubs, these massive logistics centers, and the returns over there look incredibly flashy,
Oh, yeah.
very fly.
Very fun.
But the mechanics feel completely foreign. So for decades, everyday investors have just been forced into this really rigid binary choice. But like, what if that entire way of looking at property investment is completely outdated?
Honestly, holding on to that binary mindset is actively keeping a lot of people from building truly resilient wealth.
Right.
We tend to operate under this assumption that we have to, choose an identity as an investor.
Instead of just building a functional system.
Exactly.
Well, that is exactly what we are getting into today. Welcome to the deep dive. We are exploring this really fascinating breakdown of an industry article. It's called Residential versus Commercial Fractional Property Investment.
It's a great piece.
It really is. And our mission for this deep dive today is simple. We want to shortcut your learning curve on property investing.
Yeah, saving you the headache.
Exactly. We're moving past the old school either-or choices and exploring this completely new framework for how you can build a resilient portfolio.
Spot on.
Okay, let's unpack this because right out of the gate, the material we're diving into points out something super counterintuitive. It says that asking, what is the best real estate investment, is it's actually the wrong question entirely.
It really is.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the question almost everyone starts with, right?
Yeah.
And it immediately leads them down a dead end.
How so?
Well, we naturally crave an objective best. Like, we want a financial advisor or some complex spreadsheet to just tell us, hey, a downtown apartment is mathematically superior to a suburban logistics warehouse.
Right, just give me the answer key.
Yeah, but the reality of real estate simply does not work like that.
Yeah.
The better choice actually has very little to do with the physical property itself.
Wait, really?
Yeah, it has absolutely everything to do with you.
Yeah.
It's about matching the asset type to your specific financial goals, your time horizon, and your personal tolerance for risk.
Okay, that makes sense.
Oh.
Let's break down that traditional divide before we get into the new investment models, because the psychology driving this whole thing is just so interesting to me.
It's fascinating. Let's start with residential, yeah.
Yeah, let's start there, because there's a reason almost everyone starts their real estate journey looking at houses or like small
Not
apartments.
sure.
And that reason is just simple familiarity. I mean, you live in a house or an apartment. I live in a house. We all interact with residential real estate every single day of our lives.
And that daily interaction, it strips away the intimidation factor. You do not need a degree in macroeconomics to understand that human beings will always need a place to sleep.
Right, like the fundamental demand is always there.
Exactly. Housing demand tends to remain incredibly steady, especially in growing urban areas. When you've got population expansion and new infrastructure constantly driving that fundamental need, the investment just feels tangible. It feels understandable.
It's the ultimate appeal for the stability-focused investor. Like, if you want lower volatility, you just naturally gravitate toward residential.
Oh, absolutely.
It's kind of like ordering your favorite reliable comfort food. You know exactly what you're going to get. But then on the other side of the fence, you have commercial real estate.
It's a spicy chef special.
Ah, exactly. The spicy chef's special. We're talking office spaces, retail storefronts, logistics facilities, and hospitality assets like big hotels.
Right.
This side of the market appeals to people looking for stronger growth or, much higher income potential.
Because the yields on commercial properties can be significantly stronger than residential.
Yeah.
I mean, no question.
But there's a catch, right?
A huge structural catch,
Right.
which is exactly why it scares everyday investors away. Commercial real estate is highly cyclical, and it's extremely sensitive to broader economic conditions.
So it's a rougher ride.
Very rough. think about the mechanics of it. Mm-hmm. Like a retail space relies entirely on consumer discretionary spending.
Right. People buying stuff they don't actually need.
Exactly. So if the economy dips and people stop buying luxury goods, that retail tenant might just break their lease. Or hospitality that relies on global tourism trends. Offices rely on corporate expansion.
I was actually thinking about it like a cargo ship. Like your investment portfolio is the ship.
Okay, I like this.
Yeah, so residential real estate feels like the ballast down in the hole. It's incredibly heavy. It's kind of boring. You don't really look at it. But it keeps the entire ship from flipping over when a massive storm hits.
Yeah, that's a great way to look at it.
And then commercial real estate is the sail. It catches the wind, it creates momentum, and it actually drives you across the ocean to your destination.
Right.
And the thing is, you cannot safely cross an ocean with just an enormous sail. And you certainly won't go anywhere fast if all you have is a heavy hull full of ballast.
The cargo ship analogy captures the function perfectly. But we do have to add one more variable to the commercial side.
Oh, what's that?
Duration risk.
Okay, break that down for me.
Well, a bad residential tenant might cost you a few months of lost rent and, you know, maybe some minor repairs, like patching some drywall.
Sure. Annoying, but not the end of the world.
Right. But a bad commercial lease or a sudden shift in the local economy, that can leave a massive, highly specialized space vacant for 5 to 10 years.
Oh, wow. 5 to 10 years with zero income.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The wind doesn't just push the sail. If you aren't careful, it can shred it entirely.
Okay. That brings up something I really want to push back on because I'm curious about the psychology here.
Yeah, go for it.
Is the psychological comfort of residential real estate actually like a massive blind spot for everyday people?
Hmm.
Like, does feeling comfortable with what we know trick newer investors into ignoring the long-term growth potential of commercial assets? Are we really just buying houses because we're inherently scared of warehouses?
What's fascinating here is how behavioral finance plays into this. It isn't necessarily a trick, you know? It's really an issue of perspective.
Respect to how?
Well, the source text highlights this perfectly. Two investors can look at the exact same commercial opportunity and see completely different realities based on their own psychological makeup.
Okay, give me an example. Let's say you and I are looking at the exact same building.
Right. Let's say we're looking at a brand new logistics hub on the edge of a rapidly growing city.
Okay. I'm picturing it.
You might look at it and see incredible growth potential. You see the unstoppable rise of e-commerce, high tenant demand from delivery companies, and highly attractive long-term yields.
Yeah, I'm seeing dollar signs.
Right. But I might look at that exact same logistics hub and see extreme vulnerability. I might see economic sensitivity, the threat of changing global supply chains, and, you know, high volatility if consumer spending drops.
So we're both right.
Exactly. Neither of us is mathematically wrong.
It's like a financial Rorschach test. The building doesn't change, but what we project onto it does.
That's a perfect way to phrase it. It heavily relies on your personality and your comfort with risk-adjusted returns.
I see.
If you are someone who prioritizes protecting your capital above all else, the quote-unquote blind spot of missing out on high commercial returns isn't a blind spot at all.
It's just a deliberate choice.
Exactly. It's a valid choice to prioritize stability. But if you actually have a higher risk tolerance and you're letting the mere unfamiliarity of commercial leases keep you out of the market, then yeah, your comfort zone is actively costing you money over the long term.
So for decades, you basically had to choose your identity. I am a ballast investor, or I am a sail investor, because traditional property investment required so much upfront capital.
Yep. Massive barriers to entry.
You had to save up a massive down payment, which meant you had to dump all of your eggs into one single basket. You simply could not afford to buy, you know, a suburban duplex A&D, a downtown office suite at the same time. You had to pick a side and just hope for the best.
You had to commit entirely to a single property category. That made meaningful diversification, which, by the way, is the bedrock of wealth preservation, almost impossible for the average person.
Well, here's where it gets really interesting, because in the deep dive material, we arrive at the core disruptor that changes this entire paradigm.
Oh, yeah. This is the game changer.
Fractional ownership. Like, what if you didn't have to choose between the hull and the sail? What if you could just custom build the entire ship?
That is the power of the fractional or shared ownership model. It completely shatters that capital barrier.
Right. Because investors can now spread their exposure flexibly across residential, commercial, logistics, and mixed-use sectors all at the exact same time.
Yes.
You can buy smaller stakes in multiple asset classes. And because of that, the fundamental question of real estate investing totally flips.
It shifts from a question of capital to a question of strategy.
Which is huge. You stop asking, can I afford this massive property? And you start asking, what type of property exposure actually makes the most sense for my portfolio?
Exactly. You don't have to think in absolutes anymore.
You can build a custom balance of stability, income generation, and growth. But wait, let's get practical for a second. Physically, how does this actually work?
Sure.
Because my name obviously isn't going on the title deed to a $50 million logistics hub next to a shipping port. So what am I actually buying? Are we talking about shares in a holding company, or is this like tokenized on a blockchain somewhere?
Usually it involves a special purpose vehicle or an SPV.
An SPV.
Yeah. You aren't buying the physical bricks directly. A highly regulated legal entity, the SPV, is created for the sole purpose of purchasing and holding that specific property.
Okay, so the entity owns the building.
Right. And when you invest, you are buying shares of that SPV. Your percentage of ownership in that entity entitles you to that exact same percentage of the net rental income and eventually the capital appreciation when the asset is sold down the line.
Okay, but hang on. This is where the whole concept feels a little bit abstracted from reality.
How so?
Buildings are physical things. They break. If I own, let's say, 1% of a logistics hub and the roof completely caves in after a massive storm, who pays for that? Do I get an unexpected bill in the mail for $10,000?
Oh, no.
Because I feel like fractional ownership might accidentally mask the reality that real estate requires massive physical and financial upkeep.
That is a brilliant pushback, and it gets right to the heart of operational credibility. No, you'd not get a bill in the mail. But you absolutely do pay for it.
Okay, how? If I'm not getting billed directly, where does the money come from?
Through reduced dividends.
Mm.
A properly structured fractional asset manager, and honestly, this is where doing your homework is non-negotiable, they will build a capital expenditure or CapEx reserve fund into the financial model from day one.
CapEx reserve fund.
Yeah. Think of it like an emergency savings account for the building. A portion of the gross rental income is siphoned off every single month into this war chest, specifically designated for roof repairs, HVAC replacements, or structural issues.
Oh, I see. So if the roof caves in, the SPV just pays for it out of that reserve.
Correct.
So the impact is absorbed before the profit ever even reaches my bank account.
Exactly. And this raises an important question about accessibility.
Right.
Just because fractional ownership makes it incredibly easy to click a button and buy a fraction of a complex commercial center, it does not magically make the underlying asset bulletproof.
Yeah, the building is still a building.
Right. Transparency and management quality matter immensely. Strong investment performance still relies entirely on asset quality, tenant demand, and the operational credibility of the people managing that CapEx reserve.
So accessibility does not replace the need for due diligence?
Not at all.
If the hospitality sector takes a massive dive because tourism drops, my fractional share of a hotel is going to take a hit just as if I own the entire building.
The underlying risk of the asset doesn't change just because your share is smaller. The key difference is that fractional ownership allows you to absorb that hit much better if you strategically balanced it with fractional shares in, say, stable residential apartments.
Because you aren't wiped out by one bad event in one sector.
Exactly. But you still have to evaluate the opportunities carefully. You cannot just throw money at complex sectors blindly just because the buy-in is lower.
So the tool is significantly better, but you still have to know how to swing the hammer.
That's a great way to put it.
And that actually brings us to how this strategy is actively playing out in the real world right now, because the article dives into this. The evolving real estate market in Saudi Arabia serves as a really fascinating real-world laboratory for this shift.
The market there is a perfect case study right now.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's evolving rapidly, driven by massive economic expansion and these huge new urban mega projects. And because of this rapid growth, diversification has become a massive priority for Saudi investors.
Right, because there's a growing widespread awareness of the risks of concentrating too much money in one local asset. Like, investors who are historically tied to single, massive local properties are realizing that a single economic shock to one neighborhood can wipe out a huge portion of their wealth.
Yeah, they're waking up to the danger of the single basket approach.
And a company called Osul Gamma is highlighted in the sources as actively supporting this evolution.
Right, Osul Gamma.
They're offering professionally managed shared ownership opportunities across all these different real estate sectors in Saudi Arabia.
Which is key.
Yeah, so investors don't have to commit entirely to a single property. And importantly, they have professional management handling the complexities of those CapEx reserves and tenant negotiations we just talked about.
But what is equally important to the companies offering these products is the regulatory environment adapting to support them.
Right, the laws have to keep up.
Because you cannot just launch these tools in a vacuum.
Yeah.
Modern ownership structures are currently being tested within REGA's regulatory sandbox over in Saudi Arabia.
Okay, let's pause on that. Yeah. What exactly is a regulatory sandbox? Because I'll be honest, in the traditional finance world, sandbox sounds like a playground for bankers with zero oversight.
Huh. I know it sounds like that, but it's the exact opposite of zero oversight.
Okay, explain.
Normally, offering fractional shares of an asset triggers massive, heavy-handed securities regulations.
Right, sure.
It can take years of legal wrangling to clear a new financial product for public investment, which often suffocates innovation before it can even start. A regulatory sandbox, like the one run by REGA, the Real Estate General Authority, basically acts as a legal quarantine zone.
A quarantine zone, meaning they contain the blast radius if something goes wrong with the financial plumbing.
Yes. It limits systemic risk. It allows companies to legally bypass some of that traditional red tape temporarily, but only with a strictly limited pool of investors and under intense scrutiny.
Oh, so they're being watched like a hawk.
The regulators literally stand right over their shoulders and watch the mechanisms work in real time. It ensures that as these new, highly accessible investment tools hit the wider market, they're transparent, secure, and structurally sound.
That's incredibly smart.
It protects the everyday investor while still allowing the market to safely innovate.
That provides a huge layer of confidence. And, you know, reading through how these markets are evolving, something else really stood out to me about the mindset of experienced investors.
Oh, that.
It's noted in the text that experienced investors rarely focus on chasing the highest possible return on a single asset. Instead, they prioritize sustainability, consistency, and risk management across the board.
Which is deeply counterintuitive for a lot of beginners.
Really?
Oh, yeah. When you first get into investing, the instinct is to just look for the highest percentage yield and dump all your money there.
Right. We want the spicy chef's special every single time.
Exactly. But chasing that maximum yield means taking on maximum volatility. If we connect this to the bigger picture, experienced investors focus on acquiring non-correlated assets.
Hold on, you're throwing around non-correlated assets. Translate that into plain English for me and the listener.
Sure. Non-correlated assets are investments that do not move in the same direction at the same time.
Okay.
So if the stock market crashes, people still need a place to live, so residential real estate might hold steady.
Right.
Or if remote work empties out office buildings, well, maybe e-commerce is booming, meaning your logistics warehouses are generating massive yields.
Oh, I see.
By holding both, one asset success cancels out the other's failure. The math of your overall portfolio becomes significantly less volatile.
Okay, so does this mean the era of the get-rich-quick property flipper is essentially being replaced by a more, like, institutional balanced approach for everyday people?
A resounding yes. The flipper mentality is inherently speculative. It relies almost entirely on short-term market timing, which is incredibly risky and honestly just stressful.
Yeah, nobody wants that stress.
What fractional ownership does is allow the everyday person to invest with the exact same mechanics as a multi-billion dollar institution.
So they get to play the defensive long game.
Exactly. The ultimate goal is long-term portfolio quality. A balanced portfolio that combines residential assets for that baseline stability and commercial assets for the yield and income generation. It's simply more practical.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense.
It is much more resilient to economic shocks than relying on a single house you're desperately hoping to flip in 6 months for a quick profit.
Yeah.
Institutions have invested this way for decades because the math works. And now, the technology and the legal frameworks exist for you to do it, too.
It's a total leveling of the playing field. So what does this all mean for you?
Yeah, what's the takeaway here?
If you're that person sitting on some savings, staring at the intimidating brick wall of real estate we talked about at the beginning, the ultimate takeaway from this deep dive is that the wall is just an illusion. You are no longer forced into a binary choice. You do not have to identify as just a residential investor or just a commercial investor. By taking the time to honestly understand your own risk tolerance, and by utilizing these new fractional ownership models, you can strategically balance stability, growth, and income.
That's exactly it.
You can finally build a portfolio that reflects your actual life goals, not just the limitations of your budget.
And as you think about how to construct that portfolio, I'll leave you with one final thought to mull over.
Let's hear it.
We talked extensively about how residential property feels less intimidating because we understand the physical separation between where we live and where we do business.
Right. Houses for sleeping, offices for working.
Exactly. But look at the macroeconomic trends happening around us right now. Remote work has permanently turned our living rooms into corporate offices.
Oh, true.
Online shopping and ultra-fast delivery networks have turned our quiet suburban neighborhoods into active logistics endpoints.
Oh, wow. The lines are completely blurring.
They are blurring rapidly. Will the hard physical distinction between a residential asset and a commercial asset eventually disappear entirely?
That's a wild thought.
And if the spaces we occupy become truly mixed use by default, where we sleep, work, and consume in the exact same footprint, how will that force us to completely redefine what a stable property investment even looks like a decade from now?
Man, that is a fascinating question, and it's definitely something that changes the way you look at the buildings around you every time you walk down the street.
Totally.
Well, thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning those old assumptions, keep looking for the mechanical nuances behind the headlines, and we will catch you on the next one.